Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Who am I? These words are the repeated cry of Jean Valjean, the protagonist of Les Miserables. Originally a Victor Hugo novel, before being immortalized as an incredibly moving staged musical. Les Mis opens with Valjean, a French peasant, imprisoned for stealing a loaf of bread to feed his sister's starving child. Better get that rolling. While imprisoned, he appears to have all but lost his identity, not least because he is subject to brutal treatment, but also because he is now numbered 24601, before eventually assuming a false name to avoid further imprisonment. As a result, he continually cries out, "Who am I?" Is he indeed now no more than a number, repeatable and replaceable? Or is he still Jean, an individual with a proper name, unrepeatable and irreplaceable, precisely because he is unique, an individual with dignity and a destiny to accomplish? This is the question I propose to answer this evening. Who am I? And indeed, who are you? And also, who are we? Though I will attend to the first with focus, the latter two will hover at the periphery of our focal point at all times. It is a question at once personal, psychological, ethical, while also possessing profound theological significance. It is the question that burns in the heart of every human individual as each of us search out our identity before the face of God. We who are made to his image. It is then a question at once individual and interpersonal, at once communal and political. Now, I want to begin our exploration of this question from a particular vantage point, one that I hope will make sense by the end of our evening. And so I want to begin with a story, a tale of seeming little significance, but which has remained with me now for almost 30 years. When I was still at university in Galway, on the west coast of Ireland, I first traveled to the United States to find seasonal work over summer break and experience adventure in a foreign land. I secured a job at a realtor in a resort city on the coast with responsibility to service apartments and fix minor breakages. Every morning, I would take the bus about 60 blocks to our offices, and it is with these daily bus rides my story begins. Since I regularly took the bus at the same time, I often had the same bus driver, an old, portly man who greeted each passenger every day without fail, with the kind of personal presence you rarely find in public transport, especially in a busy city during rush hour. The personal manner of his presence was deeply impressive. And it wasn't just his greeting. As he sat and drove between stops, he somehow managed to maintain that mode of being personally present. Now, to be clear, he wasn't at all effusive. But, in his own understated way, he was, nevertheless, remarkable. So remarkable, in fact, that, as I've said, he left an indelible impression upon me, one that I have never been able, nor even inclined, to shake. And it was all because of his face. His face has remained with me to this day, because it seemed to me then, and still seems to me now, that his face bore forth his person and personality into the world. It bore his temperament and character, together with the story of his life, all now enshrined in an unforgettable face. His was a life that undoubtedly faced much difficulty, as all do, but which had nonetheless come to communicate the calm presence of a personality made whole, a personal subject who was at peace with the world, facing the world in a personal way, unfazed by its distracting intensity, even during rush hour traffic. This seemingly insignificant story anchors my talk tonight because it provides a point of departure that I believe uniquely highlights the central insights of Thomistic personalism. For those unfamiliar, Thomistic personalism is a movement in contemporary thought that places the person at the center of its reflections, while also tracing its roots into the perennially valid thought of St. Thomas Aquinas. More formally stated, Thomistic personalism takes St. Thomas's conception of the person as its cornerstone, while deepening this conception with insights received from a contemporary movement in philosophy called phenomenology. And it does so primarily through the insights of Saints Edith Stein and Karol Wojtyła. In brief, phenomenology can be described as a way of doing philosophy that closely attends to conscious experience. It recognizes in conscious experience the foundation of all knowing and seeks to unpack the entire contents of experience, leaving nothing behind. Now, because of this, phenomenology is uniquely situated to attend to the significance of personal subjectivity. And Thomistic personalists, recognizing that St. Thomas's presentation of the substantiality of the person lies open to the inclusion of subjectivity, argue that this extension is necessary if our understanding of the person is to be appropriately complete. In accord with this, I take the face as my vantage point precisely because I believe the face most eloquently exhibits the mystery of being a person. It duly focuses our attention on the centrality of subjectivity. Now, that is simply to say that when we turn our gaze toward the world in which we find ourselves, within the broad horizon of human experience, with all its wondrous density, we find the human face at the center captivating our attention, and, if we are rightly disposed, coordinating our action. The reason the face does this is because it is the most meaningful object. It expresses truth and goodness in a maximal way. That is the truth and goodness of being a person. And more pointedly for our purposes, the truth and goodness of personal subjectivity. In the human face, we discover the presence of a personal subject, an imago Dei, who becomes manifest to me via their facial expression and voiced communication. And in every face-to-face encounter, we discover the potential to have a properly personal encounter. And so we come to my thesis for this evening, namely that the human face is the centerpiece of creation, precisely because it reveals the presence of a personal subject. A person who looks back at me while I look at him, who addresses me with his gaze and voice, a person to whom I'm to respond with my very self, at least if I'm not to turn everything on its head. Now let us begin our exploration with St. Thomas, pure and simple, and his objective and substantial understanding of the person. For Aquinas, a fundamental dichotomy divides the whole of reality. It is a dichotomy that distinguishes persons and non-persons. Though this division is subsequent to the one dividing creator and creation, it is nonetheless a division that embraces the whole of reality. Encompassing both creator and creation, by distinguishing the divine, the angelic, and the human, as personal beings from all non-personal beings, that is, from everything else. We see this clearly in St. Thomas when he notes that the person, as a term, picks out the most perfect of beings, those that are most complete most whole, and most full of being. And he thereby distinguishes persons from all that is subpersonal. Thus, pithily, he says, the term person signifies that which is most perfect in all of nature. The primary explanation Aquinas gives for this perfection is the rational principle. Aquinas's reasoning is simple. He argues that those who subsist in a rational nature, namely persons, are individual in a more special and perfect way, because they have dominion over their actions. And it is for this reason that such individuals have a special name, and this name is person. Now, given the brevity of Aquinas' reasoning, it would be easy to pass over this explanation without properly attending to the depth of its meaning. Yet, that would be a mistake, and a serious one at that. Whereas all other things act out of their natures, and only out of their natures, persons act out of themselves as individuals. My actions are not merely the actions of a human, a singular of the species. No, they are mine. I am their origin, and if I did not choose them, they would not be, and neither would their goodness, or indeed their badness. And it is the very same for you. Your actions are yours. You are their origin, and if you did not choose them, they would not be, and likewise, neither were their goodness or their badness. This free dominion is then the coordinating centerpiece of personal life, for it is precisely this mode of life that grounds the singular creativity of the human individual. This creativity is found in all sorts of ways, but is no more eloquently exhibited than when persons shape the world by bestowing it with further truth, goodness, and beauty. The dominion persons have over their actions is then the nexus through which the singular dignity of the person passes. Yet for Aquinas, personal action is significant not only because of such creativity. No, its ultimate significance lies much closer to home, in the acting person himself, and in what becomes of him through his actions, either becoming virtuous by performing morally good acts, or vicious by doing the very opposite. The dominion persons have over their actions is then also the nexus through which the ethical development of the person passes. Yet, again, the developing character of the person is not the only further significance. No, its significance travels right to the core of what it means to be a person, because through virtuous action, the unique personality of the individual begins to fold and unfold over the course of time, or, conversely, through vice, stunt and deform. The dominion persons have over their own actions is then also the nexus through which the personality passes. Now, taking these three together, that free personal action is the nexus of dignity, character, and personality, that through which everything passes, we see that the natural perfection possessed by each person, by being that which is most perfect in all nature, is apt to be embraced by the individual himself, and then ideally oriented toward its proper ethical and personal completion. In this way, the grounding dignity of the person can be consummated by its further personal perfection. In this is our primary responsibility. Now, should we look at all this from a theological perspective, we see that this responsibility of the creaturely side of the mystery of salvation is immense, for as St. Augustine reminds us, though God has created us without ourselves, he will not save us without ourselves. Now, all this has been wonderfully summarized nearly two millennia ago by St. Gregory of Nyssa. He says the following, and I quote, "All things subject to change and becoming never remain constant, but continually pass from one state to another, for better or worse. Now, human life is always subject to change. It needs to be born ever anew. But here, birth does not come about by foreign intervention, as is the case with bodily beings. No, it is the result of free choice. Thus, we are in a certain way our own parents, creating ourselves as we will by our decisions. Now, doesn't this quote, drawn from nearly two millennia ago, capture the contemporary zeitgeist most powerfully? For what is the spirit of this age proclaiming more loudly than that we are our own makers, creating ourselves as we will by pure fiat? We could here think of all that is happening with the trans movement in all its forms, whether gender, race, age, or species. And we could also think of the identity politics movement more broadly, an ideology which places emphasis on the indeterminate liberty of the individual to assert its own identity. And yet there is a key difference separating St. Gregory's perennial wisdom from this contemporary zeitgeist. For St. Gregory and the majority of the Western tradition, including St. Thomas, we do not and cannot create what we are, while at one and the same time, we must take responsibility to shape who we are becoming through our personal action. Who, not what. This is the distinction that matters, and is a distinction with all the difference in the world. What is given? You and I are human, persons made to the image of God. But who we are, this remains in our own hands. You and I have the dignity and the responsibility to shape our human selves over the course of a hopefully long and full life. Now, from what has already been outlined, we seem to have a firm foundation for a Thomistic personalism, for we already have a teaching that duly emphasized both the significance of the person and the allied significance of personal action. In light of this, then, we can understandably ask, why isn't this enough? Why isn't what has already been outlined a statement of Thomistic personalism, whole and simple, even if just in its central tenets? To answer this objection, I want to call to mind an insight of Wojtyła. It is found in his seminal essay, Subjectivity and the Irreducible in Man. This brings to light an essential feature of personal life that St. Thomas just did not simply attend to. Wojtyła says, "The experience of man cannot be exhausted by means of cosmological reduction. We must consider the irreducible, what in every man is unique and unrepeatable, through which he is not only this man in particular, an individual of the species, but through which he is a person, a subject. Only then is the image of man correct and complete." Close quotation. Just so, Wojtyła encourages us to advance beyond the objective and substantialist understanding of the person given brilliantly by Aquinas, however true it is. Despite its truth, if Wojtyła is correct, Aquinas' account must be supplemented by a corresponding account of subjectivity and its significance. We need to, in the words of Wojtyła, pause at or dwell upon the irreducible of personal subjectivity, for only then can we render the image of man correct and complete. But what is this irreducibility? Simply stated, the irreducibility of subjectivity is rooted in the capacity of the person to be aware and self-aware, and both together in an awareness that is at once self-awareness. Now, by awareness here, I mean the presence of the person to the objective world, And by self-awareness, I mean the concomitant presence of the person to the subjective self. This simultaneity of presence, awareness and self-awareness together, is absolutely essential to personal life. Indeed, it is that without which personal life would be inconceivable. For in all knowing, in all willing, in all feeling, awareness makes possible the appearance of the world. And together with it, self-awareness makes it possible that this appearance be for someone. This makes awareness absolutely foundational for personal life in a strict sense. And indeed, it is that behind which we can find no further vantage point. Nothing behind awareness to view awareness. It is that behind which there is no further explanation. Because of this, awareness cannot be resolved into anything else. It is the ground and center in which the world appears and appears for someone, for me and for you. And just so, it is irreducible. Now, awareness together with self-awareness is the core of consciousness. To be conscious means to be with knowledge, conscientiae, with knowledge. Let's look at the knowledge part first. In ancient and medieval thinkers, including Aquinas, knowledge is clearly present, and its essential character is detailed with great acuity. They account for knowledge by explaining that it is best understood as the union of knower and known, an intellectual act that results in the most profound union possible. Indeed, the scriptures describe the conjugal act of man and woman as an act of knowledge, because it takes knowledge to be the profoundest of unions. However, these same thinkers, including Aquinas, pay little attention to what is with knowledge, or indeed what it means to be with knowledge. Yet these latter questions are important if we want to understand human experience in its perspective from the character of subjectivity. Knowing is never merely a knowing of some or other thing, an act of knowledge that, so to speak, hovers in the void without any knowing subject. No, it is always a knowing by someone who is both aware of what is known and self-aware that he is the one doing the knowing. And so too, willing is always a willing by someone who is aware of what is willed and self-aware that he is the one willing. And so too, feeling is always a feeling by someone who is both aware of what is felt and self-aware that he is the one experiencing the feeling. Evidently, such awareness comes self-awareness is foundational. It is that capacity to which the world becomes a world for us. By awareness, the person draws the world to himself, so that what is objective about the objects of the world becomes something properly subjective, and indeed a possession of the subject, of you and me. By way of concrete example, at this moment, I am aware of you, and I am aware that I am aware of you. And moreover, you are aware of me, and you are aware that you are aware of me. And finally, we are both aware that we are aware of one another. At least, if you're still awake. Thus, we can summarize and say, while we are objectively aware of the world, we are simultaneously subjectively aware of ourselves. Otherwise stated, we subjectively achieve an objective awareness of the world. And it cannot be otherwise. Now, this makes awareness come self-awareness a sine qua non of personal life. It is that without which our lives are inconceivable. For what will be left of us should we efface this dual capacity? And just give that a moment's thought. If at this moment all of our awareness was to be effaced, what would be left of us? Seems all that is personal would cease. This doesn't make awareness a whole account of what is personal, but it is a foundation from which all that is personal appears. Indeed, should we remove awareness come self-awareness, we wouldn't be able to announce anything whatsoever. We wouldn't even be able to make the simplest statement of all, the plain and basic first-person enunciation, I am. Now, it is with this last statement, this small sentence, I am, that we come to the very heart of personal subjectivity. For in this statement, we find the highest dignity of the personal subject. Why? Well, we alight upon something that is at once our most personal possession, each of us individually, while it also establishes us in a most intimate relation with God. How so? Well, because it is right here that we find an echo of the divine name, the name we share with the name God has communicated to us through Moses via the burning bush. We recall the story of Exodus, and in verse 3:14, God declares that he is the great I am. He is the one who says, I am who I am, or I am he who is, or I am what I am, depending on how you translate the Hebrew. Or more straightforwardly, as the sacred scriptures repeat the name, just I am. Now, as a consequence of this coincidence of enunciation, every personal subject duly developed is able to simultaneously declare their own being, their own life, their own subjectivity, while at one and the same time announcing the name of God, and doing so in a personal way. The I am of the personal subject is then, so to speak, an echo of the divine name, resonating throughout time and history in every personal subject. Such a small statement, such a simple sentence. Now, when Stein, St. Edith Stein, pauses at and dwells upon the irreducible of personal subjectivity, her reflections provide a highly refined understanding of its structure from the perspective of human interiority, the interiority of the soul. In a sweeping quotation from Finite and Eternal Being, Stein brings all important elements into play, elements that are once Thomistic, Augustinian, and Carmelite, as well as phenomenological and psychological. She says, the soul is the space in the middle of the body-soul-spirit whole. As sensitive, the soul dwells in the living body, in all its members shaping and preserving the body, while also receiving from it. As spiritual, the soul rises above the self and looks out upon the world, entering into dialogue with the world and receiving from it. But as soul in the most proper sense, the soul is the dwelling place of the personal I. The eye that faces the world and gathers into itself everything received from this encounter with all that is other. What is therein gathered becomes our most personal property, an integral part of the very self, what figuratively speaking becomes our flesh and blood. Stein continues, the soul is then not point-like, like the personal I. Rather, it is spatially expansive. Truly, it is an interior castle, a dwelling place with many rooms, a home within which the personal I dwells and throughout which the I can move about freely, at times moving outward, at times drawing inward. This interior expanse is then not empty, like a vacant space, a warehouse without structure or definition. Even while a fullness, the fullness of the world can enter into it and be taken up by it. And indeed it must be so if the soul is to unfold its own peculiar life. and to do so precisely in the unfolding of the individual personality. Now, much could be said about this significant passage, especially given its syncretic character, uniting so many traditions and so many disciplines. But I wish here to focus only on how Stein interweaves the objective and the subjective, and thus comes to her most significant conclusion, at least for anthropology. Immediately we see that Stein explains that the person possesses a personal I, which dwells in an interior castle, the castle of the soul. And thereby she brings us to the two fundamental dimensions of our personal subjectivity, namely the personal I and the interior castle. First, the personal I. For Stein, subjectivity possesses a dimensionless inner kernel, the conscious I. The conscious I is the apex of our personal life, the place where each person rises to the brightness of consciousness and faces the objective world as aware and simultaneously self-aware. And since the conscious I wields the powers of the soul, reason and will and all other powers subject to reason and will, the conscious I is a personal I. And indeed, it is precisely because it wields these capacities that the conscious I can live as a subject oriented toward what is objective in the world, in all knowing, willing, and feeling, and thereby bring the objective world into union with the subjective self. Then, the second dimension, the interior castle. Personal subjectivity for Stein also possesses an expansive inner structure. It is a mansion with many rooms. It is a place within which the I dwells. The whole of this inner expanse lies at the disposal of the I. It is not bound to any one location, but has the potential to move about freely, ideally taking up its proper place in their innermost depth. And since the soul, as the principle of life, is a living thing, this castle is not static, rigidly circumscribed. No, the soul has a capacity to grow, develop, and mature as it unfolds its structure over the course of life and experience. This unfolding takes place when the I encounters the meaning and value of the objective world and incorporates this nourishment into the soul, becoming its very flesh and blood. Moreover, by this reception, overseen by the I as the gardener of the soul matures towards its proper stature, precisely in as much as the personal I brings the objective meaningfulness of the world into the subjective self and makes it one with the self. Now, as we can see, Stein argues that the innermost depth of the soul, what she calls elsewhere the soul of the soul, is the most fitting dwelling place for the I, and for two reasons. Living from the depth enables the I to harness all of the power of the soul and wield the powers of the soul, reason and will and all other powers, in fervent engagement with the world, its persons, things, events, and states of affairs. And because of this, the I is then able to embrace the entire range of its creative potential, but with respect to its capacity to shape the world, and with respect to its corresponding capacity to shape the self, before ideally becoming who God created the person to be. Just so, we see how the subjectivity of the individual can flourish only if the I assumes responsibility for the world and for the self and for both together. Moreover, we see how the personal I can do so only by taking up its dwelling place in the innermost depth, the soul of the soul. Now, lest this be misunderstood, and as should already be apparent, this journey into the depth is not at all a removal from the world, a cowering into the safety of the self in hiding from reality. It is not a selfish act. No, it is a fully responsible act. An act that bears weight both for the good of the world and for the good of the self. Since consciousness is oriented outward by nature, in an orientation that potentially embraces the whole of reality, including God, the personal subject can achieve personal maturity only through engagement with what is objective in the world. Now, this follows directly upon the meaning of subject and object. These are two inherently correlated realities. There is no subjectless objectivity, and likewise, there is no objectless subjectivity. Thus, properly speaking, genuine subjectivity implies intending things with focused objectivity, and genuine objectivity implies appropriating the objective world with deepened subjectivity. To become more subjective in the true sense, then, is likewise to become more objective, and to become more objective in the true sense is likewise to become more subjective. Just so we see a kind of telescoping happens when the eye journeys into the depth of the soul. A telescoping that brings the objective world into view with greater resolution, with greater density of meaning and value. We can then conclude that in living a more profound inner life with greater subjective intensity, the personal individual encounters the world more deeply and widely, that is, with greater objective intensity. And it is precisely because of this that we must learn to lose ourselves in the objective in order to find ourselves in the subjective, and thereby become the persons that God has made us to be. Now, let's state all this more simply, more plainly, and with greater existential valence. To live at the surface of one's soul is to possess a shallow subjectivity, and consequently to experience the objective world only superficially. On the other hand, to live at the depth of one's soul is to possess a concentrated subjectivity, and consequently to experience the objective world with the profundity that its goodness, truth, and beauty demands. Now, before proceeding to the conclusion of my thesis, let's briefly summarize the results so far. On the one hand, the person is an objective substance with a structure that requires clear delineation. This is so because we need to understand the human being in itself, and we need to classify the human species within the broader cosmos whole, amongst other natural kinds. Yet, on the other hand, the person possesses a subjective mode of life that requires careful illumination, both in order to encounter the individual in a properly personal way, and in order to properly detail this subjectivity as part of the objective structure of the person. Let's state this more plainly. The human person is not simply a what, but a who. Not merely something, but someone. Not solely an object, but a subject. Now let's return to the significance of the face. It is my thesis that we see the centrality of both dimensions, the substantiality of the person and the subjectivity of the person, when we attend to the human face. Let us recall that for St. Thomas, the person is that which is most perfect in all of nature. As a being possessing the apex perfection of being, rational freedom, the person bears the greatest density of truth and goodness. But where is this fullness of truth and goodness most manifest? One could even say most radiant than in the human face. Though the whole of the body manifests the presence of a person, nonetheless, the person is certainly most evident in the face. Thus, Stein can say, the face surpasses all other bodily parts in the subtlety and diversity of its movements. One can see in the face the most perfect self-revelation of the person. With the fully unself-conscious, we have an unbroken stream of life, where eye and facial expression are the untroubled mirror of the soul. Somewhat later, she continues, "The stirrings of the heart and the will have an especially strong forming power. The impress given to the body, and in a special measure to the face, presses forth the character of the soul. The face is a physical manifestation of the person in at least four ways: in its sophisticated skeletal structure, its refined organic arrangement, its often unbidden flushing or pallor, and most of all, its subtle muscular movement. Because of this, the face has a unique capacity to communicate the presence of the person, precisely because it communicates their inner life. It communicates their subjectivity. Furthermore, the face is also the ordinary locus of communication. When the interior word, the word of the heart, becomes the voiced word in an exterior word of communication to another. Just so, in its delicate lines and subtle shadings, together with its amazing expressive power and precise communicative ability, the face bears forth the person and their personality into the world. This makes the face, most definitely, the most intelligible of physical objects, the one most knowable and most understandable, as well as the most inscrutable, the most desirable, the most compelling and attractive, as well as the most elusive. And this is exactly why the face is the most interesting object. It is an object about which we can arguably never get bored, because we can never exhaust the truth and goodness of the face, because we can never exhaust the truth and goodness of the person that presses forth in their face. Now, to be perfectly clear, I'm not here speaking of the face as a mere physical thing. I'm taking the face to be the expression of subjectivity. Though in the face of the other, I certainly encounter something objective, it is utterly like all other objects. It is never merely an object. It reveals a unique personal presence. When another person stands opposite me and faces me, when this other addresses me with their expression and word, I encounter their inner life. I encounter them not only outwardly, but inwardly. In the eyes of the other, I see another eye looking back at me. In the voice of the other, I hear another eye calling out to me. He looks back at me, he calls out to me, and I answer him with myself. Or, alternatively, I can forego such a genuine personal encounter. I can meet the other with a mask. I can veil my personal presence. I can perform the expressions and acts of a person without these expressions and acts coming forth from my center. I then know I'm not acting in a personal way. I'm playing at being a person. I'm buffering myself from the other, maybe defending myself before him, or maybe attempting to overcome him by working our encounter. Of these alternate ways of interacting, Stein says, "I look into the eyes of a human being, and his look answers me. He permits me to enter into his interior, or he guards himself against my look. Thus, when two individuals look toward one another, one eye and another eye stand opposite one another. Their reciprocal gaze can be an encounter at the gates or an encounter in the interior." Accordingly, Stein concludes, the look of a human being speaks. An autonomous, aware eye looks at me from within himself. And therefore, we also say, a free spiritual person. Now, let's state all this with simplicity. In the look and voice of the other, I experience another self. I thus experience the other as one who experiences the world together with me, and who also experiences me in the very same way I experience him. And this is the important point. I then realize I am no longer the center of reality, experiencing everything from my perspective, the only perspective I have and indeed can have. No, in the face of the other, I encounter other centers of reality, numerous other centers, those with whom I can enter into a relationship, those with whom I can learn to interpret the world together and live in community. I am then no longer alone, an idiot, solitary and isolated. No, I'm in the world as an individual among individuals, a subject who stands together with others, beside others, and ideally for others, especially those for whom I'm to lose myself so that I may find myself. Moreover, I discover in the face of the other a created reflection of God, and thus discover in their look and voice that God also is addressing me. That is, if I'm not to find myself at the Last Judgment, in that most unfortunate situation when the Lord asks, sorry, when the one who asked the Lord says, Lord, when did we see you hungry and thirsty, stranger or naked, sick or in prison, and did not minister to thee? Now, let us draw all this to a close by bringing to mind that this complex of facial expression and voice communication is already found in the origin of the term person. As some of you may know, the term first arose in an ancient dramatic context. It was initially used to signify the mask worn by characters in staged plays of ancient dramas. The mask enabled the audience to identify the character with ease, and it also provided for the amplification of the actor's voice. When the term was used by early Christian theologians and philosophers to grapple with the two fundamental mysteries of the faith, namely the Trinity as one God in three persons, and the Incarnation as one person in two natures, it received an incomparable deepening. The reflection upon these mysteries, together with the doctrine of the Imago Dei, the term eventually becomes a most significant term, arguably the most significant term, that is, a term with the greatest density of meaning, person. Now, this ancient meaning is still retained in the phrase dramatis persona, dramatic person, and it is also found immortalized in the plays of Shakespeare when Jacques of As You Like It announces, all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. And Antonio in The Merchant of Venice declares, I hold the world but as the world, a stage where every man must play his part. The person and the face, these are inextricably intertwined realities. The person, a perfection of being, imaging the divine in the created world, and the face, a locus of expression and communication, bearing this image as an icon into the world. As a result, in every face-to-face encounter, wherein we encounter one another as persons, we have the potential to open the gates of our souls by taking one another as friends, or to close these same gates by taking one another as enemies. Friend or enemy, these are the counterpoise stances available to us when we meet one another. And it is by this very path, by living life before the faces of one another, both friend and enemy, that we learn to attain our true face, the face that genuinely manifests the presence of the personal self. What C.S. Lewis writes so eloquently about in his fairy tale retold, Till We Have Faces. In this novel written late in life, Lewis reveals that the attainment of one's true face is the most important task for which the person is responsible. For it is only by completing this task that we can enter into genuine relationship with one another and not live as hypocrites, those who mask themselves and perform the acts of a person, externally and without heart. Even more importantly, attaining one's true face is the only way that we can enter into genuine relationship with God. For it is only by completing this task that we can hope to appear before His face with hearts made pure. For, as Lewis says, how can God meet us face to face till we have faces? This then is our destiny, to become like that old portly man of my opening story, journeying through life with personal presence, turned toward one another, giving a home to one another in ourselves through our faces. Because we have at last learned to give a home to God in our hearts rendered pure. And just so we come back to our very beginning and we recall those other significant words of Jean Valjean, who not only cries out, "Who am I?" but who also with the rest of the Les Mis cast declares, "To love another person is to see the face of God." Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.